You're listening to the Bird Dog Babe podcast with my mom, Courtney Bastian.
This episode is presented to you by Purina Pro Plan and Boss Shot Shells.
And there's a lot of people out there that are training for the Invitational, and there's also a lot of people out there that are training and just want really good hunting dogs. And any dog that you train through UPT or UT is going to give you that well-trained hunting dog, because that's what we're doing. We're recreating situations that you would run into in a hunting scenario.
Hey, bird dog babes. My name is Courtney Bastian, and I am obsessed with all things bird dogs. And I'm here to share with you the stories, experiences, knowledge, and opinions from the women and a few guys in the industry that are killing it. I'm a Wisconsin girl living in a Montana world, mom and two incredible kiddos, wife and occasional assistant to a pro gun dog trainer, traveling the U.S. talking about canine nutrition while hunting, raising, and competing with my German wire hair pointers and Brocchi Italiano. As someone who started hunting later in life because I wanted to give my dogs the opportunity to do what they were bred to do, I'm here to help inspire, educate, and connect women to get their bird dogs out in the field and experience a bond like no other. So pour yourself a glass of wine and get ready to be challenged and encouraged while you learn. This is the Bird Dog Babe Podcast. Today we are talking all things NAVDA utility and utility prep testing. We received loads of awesome feedback from the NAVDA Natural Ability episode we did a few weeks ago, and I know many of you are waiting for this one. Angie Conan and Dan Whitman take us through this series, and in another few weeks, we will be covering the entire portion of the NAVDA Invitational to wrap up this three-part series. These are lengthy episodes, but as you learn from the first one, they are loaded with information and tips that you probably haven't heard before and will better help you prepare for these tests. All right, let's get after it. This episode is presented to you by Purina Pro Plan. What makes a great bird dog is genetics, training, and nutrition, and that's why I trust and feed Purina Pro Plan. With over 500 nutritionists, veterinarians, and scientists on staff, Pro Plan delivers a full spectrum of performance and specialized dog food formulas to help bird dogs like yours excel at every stage of life. Purina supports us, the breeders, owners, and trainers, the events we compete in, our national breed clubs, canine health research, and our committed partners to conservation groups such as Pheasants Forever, Rough Grouse Society, and Ducks Unlimited. 95 out of the top 100 dogs are fueled by the advanced nutrition of Purina Pro Plan. This episode is also presented by Boss Shot Shells. Copper-plated bismuth Boss provides a better, more effective non-lead option than steel and are safe to use in Grandpa's gun. Available in 10, 12, 16, 20, 28-gauge, and 410, direct-to-consumer pricing and cases ship right to your door. Shoot Boss, pattern your shotgun to make more clean and ethical shots, reduce crippling, and remove lead from the uplands, wetlands, and all lands. Find out more at BossShotShells.com. A big shout out to the people and the partners that are helping me to keep the MP3s rolling for this podcast. My Patreon patrons, the bread and butter, the peeps, the community of like-minded individuals that are eager to learn and offer to contribute. Join us for $5 per month on patreon.com/thebirddogbabe for exclusive discounts, content, and live Q&A sessions. 5% of your contribution goes to the AKC Canine Health Foundation, and another 5% goes to conservation. Dakota 283, unparalleled protection for your dog's travel to and from your next adventure. My favorite is the G3 kennel, which has a recessed handle on top that makes it easy for me to lift in and out of my truck. The keyed panel latching door makes me feel at ease on trips when I have to leave dogs in my truck when I stop for fuel. An added bonus is the drain hole in the back, which makes cleaning a breeze when my dog has been run hard and put away wet. Go to Dakota283.com and use promo code BIRDDOGBABE for 10% off. And by Siren, shotguns for women. Siren carries the only full line of women's shotguns. They are dedicated to providing the equipment and knowledge that make shooting and hunting more enjoyable and less stressful. Newer seasoned hunter, Siren offers multiple options that fit right out of the box. No more compromises. Go to SirenUSA.com and check out all the options available for upland, waterfowl, sporting, and trap shotguns. And while you're there, say hello to Julia, Siren's new 12-gauge sporting that is one of the most stunning shotguns I've laid my eyes on. Welcome to the podcast, Angie and Dan. I'm excited to talk about the NAVDA utility test here. We had some awesome feedback on the natural ability. But Angie, our audience, if they listen to the natural ability test, they are familiar with who you are. But I want you to give us another short intro. And then Dan, I'm going to have you kick it off from there and introduce yourself because you are our new speaker for this one.
Hello, I'm Angie Kunin. I have been with NAVDA since 2003. I raise and train German Shorthair pointers. I have 6 of them. I do breed and try to have a litter from time to time. Again, I've been in NAVDA since 2003. I've been an approved NAVDA judge since 2010, and I have been a senior judge since 2015 and an invitational judge around 2016. So it's been a great experience. I've learned a lot from NAVDA. It's made me a better trainer, judge, and hunter. So looking forward to what we can add and help people with the next phase of the utility and UPT test.
Okay. My name is Dan Whitman, and I currently reside in Phoenix, Arizona. I joined NAVDA in 1996 when I got my first German Shorthair pointer. Like most breeders that are involved in NAVDA, you know, the breeder advised me that probably be good to join an organization like this. So I did. I got my second German Shorthair pointer in 1997. I earned a versatile title with that dog in 2000. My job has taken me all over the country. So I've been a member of NAVDA in the states of, I've been a NAVDA International member, and I'm a life member, but I've been members of different chapters across the country in New York, Montana, Texas, Idaho, Colorado, and now in Phoenix, Arizona. I'm actually the president of the Valley of the Sun chapter here, and then I also am the director of testing for NAVDA International. I have 2 German Shorthair pointers currently, and I also have 2 pointers, and I have a Vizsla. I've participated in field trials off horseback, walking field trials, national shoot-to-retrieve trials, AKC. I really love to duck hunt, so that's what has constantly brought me back to NAVDA. So that's really my passion, the waterfowl and the upland hunting. So that's primarily what I do today.
So are you familiar with the testing grounds for next year then, since you're down in Arizona with the New Mexico location?
I am. I have judged out there before. Okay. It's a really nice facility. What I like about that facility is everything is right there. They even have houses right on site that the judges stay at. So there wasn't a lot of traveling when I was there. You know, some test sites, you know, you're at the mercy of whatever's available. And just the people out there, the grounds that they use, and then the chapter themselves have been great. And they're actually doing some work to improve what they already have. But, you know, they're irrigated, you know, they have some irrigated fields, some more desert like fields. The water is really good. And now they put in some additional ponds to kind of, you know, get the grounds ready for the invitational.
Being somebody that has traveled around the U.S. and I'm going to just have a personal insight here with being from Montana, but is there anything specific that's going to be different from these locations to what is going to be in New Mexico as far as scenting, tracking that we could, I don't know, have difficulty with and maybe try to simulate and prepare for beforehand?
Well, I think it goes kind of both ways. So I do have a versatile champion title on one of my pointers, and going from an arid ground in Arizona and scenting conditions out here, and then going back to I ran in Ohio. And so I work from home, and I've worked from home for like 8 years, so I have the benefit of that. So I was able to travel back and get my dogs acclimated. You know, when I train out here, I'm dragging, you know, for the blind retrieve, I'm dragging a duck into sagebrush from the edge of the, you know, of the area that I use for the open water. And I had to get the dog used to going up into trees, going up into grass. And it's going to be the same for the dogs coming from that part of the country this way. They're going to have to get used to the aridness of the air and not a lot of moisture in the air. So the scenting conditions are different, and the dog's going to have to adapt to that.
Angie, speaking of the Invitational, do you have any updates for us since we talked last time? I know we just received the running orders, so...
Yeah. One of my jobs, being on the board of directors, besides being secretary, is helping and being on the Invitational committee. And obviously, like I talked about last time, it's a lot bigger this year. We're actually running 237 dogs this year. So that's a combination of dogs that qualified in 2019 and 2020. So right now, the running days have been emailed out. I just would suggest anybody that's listening to this, if they have any questions or concerns, or maybe didn't get the running day that they were hoping, just to reach out to Deb Stott, and her contact information is on the NAVDA website. Again, that's NAVDA.org. Deb will be able to answer any questions you may have. Deb's the one that is our program manager, and so she's actually the head of the Invitational. And is giving me some of the updates as we move forward, setting all our meetings. So I encourage people that if they have any questions about this year's Invitational to reach out to Deb or myself, happy to answer any questions. But right now we are in the planning stages, and we're, you know, getting ready for boots on the ground. We're less than 6 months away. So we're excited, but there's a lot to do to lead up to it. So,
yeah, very exciting. So speaking of leading up to the Invitational, let's talk about what it takes to get there and how we're going to get prepared for, hopefully, the New Mexico location next year. So utility test, and let's also talk on the utility prep test a little bit and how that differs. If you guys could please explain what the utility test is, as far as what does that prove?
Well, the utility test is designed to show hunting dogs in hunting situations in all upland games, you know, so it has to do with anything that you're in the field or you may be duck hunting. It's simulating those scenarios. And we're also showcasing a well-behaved dog as well, a dog that has obedience. So when you give a command to a dog, is the dog listening? Is it being cooperative? And we're going to go through some of those sections. Each section looks over the cooperation, the obedience, and the desire of the dog. And again, that's trying to simulate hunting scenarios. And it's a very big jump from natural ability to utility. But I also don't want it to scare people, because a utility dog is just a little bit older dog. Generally, they're beyond that 16-month mark, up to when they can run natural ability. And it can be an intimidating jump from natural ability to utility. But utility is really showcasing your overall hunting dog and what you have.
I think, too, it's a partnership. Like, this is a test of being, to see the partnership between the hunter and the dog. Natural ability is more focused on the dog itself. But this, the cooperation and the dog knowing what you want, and then you understanding what the dog needs to do and putting the dog in the best situation like you would in hunting. I think that's what you showcase in the UPT test, and then also in utility.
As far as what it proves, is there much difference between the utility prep and the utility?
I think the utility prep test is that in-between step. So, like, one of the big differences, just like in the field situation, is the dog can break on the shot for utility prep, whereas the dog has to stand steady to wing shot and fall for the utility test and then retrieve on command. So, and some people, when they train, they want to train their dog to hunt and, they want the dog to break on the shot. You know, there's different schools of thought in regards to that. So sometimes the utility prep test is better for the person that is going to hunt their dog and wants them to break on the shot. Sometimes utility prep test is because the handler and the dog just aren't in that finished steadiness stage. And so, it gets another test situation under the dog's belt, under the handler's belt, before they also test in utility.
And really, it gets people's feet wet in the testing system because it's such a big jump from natural ability to utility. That in between test, people get a chance to see what it feels like to direction gunners in the field and what it feels like when you have to swing on your bird. All things that you need to do for utility, but it gives you more of, I feel like, a practice or a comfort level where the stakes aren't quite as high. So a dog that runs UPT cannot qualify to run in the Invitational. And there's a lot of people out there that are training for the Invitational. And there's also a lot of people out there that are training and just want really good hunting dogs. And any dog that you train through UPT or UT is going to give you that well-trained hunting dog, because that's what we're doing. We're recreating situations that you would run into in a hunting scenario.
So the dogs are still prizing, correct?
In UPT, yes, they are.
Mm-hmm. And yes. They just won't go to the Invitational. Okay.
Right. So I'll give you an example. Last year out here, because in Phoenix, the weather is hot. So our tests are usually at the end of the year. It was towards the end of the hunting season, and I was one of my dogs. I tested in utility. I didn't know how she would perform. I knew that she wasn't trained 100% to where I would want her, but I wanted to test her anyways. So I tested her on a Friday, and the steadiness is what got me, because she kept breaking on the shot. But then I tested her the next day, which was Saturday, in UPT, and got a prize one. And that was really the difference, was just the steadiness in the field.
Price wise, entry for the test, it's usually the same for UTP and utility, isn't it?
It usually is, because you're using ducks. You're using the same amount of game birds. It just fluctuates across the country. The overall test, how much it costs, because you have to figure in the how readily available the birds are. And then, if you're flying judges into an area where you don't have local judges, so they might have a test fee that's higher because just their overhead is higher. But usually the tests within that same chapter are the same cost.
Okay. The percentage of people that go from that natural ability test. So like, I know, as a breeder, when we're watching the people that get puppies from us, they're all testing in natural ability. But I mean, there's very few that really go on to that UT test. And what does that look like on a national scale for comparison?
I don't know the exact percentage, but I do know the whole reason why UPT was brought into the mix was for the very reason you're talking about. Prior to having the UPT test, they were losing, NAVDA was losing a lot of people, because it would take sometimes a year or two to train for utility, and they wouldn't see these people until they came back after natural ability. So that's why the UPT test was implemented. Try to keep people engaged and moving forward in their training. One of the things I thought just to mention that was interesting to me is a large percentage of the natural ability dogs that get a 3 in cooperation. So a lot of times that's because the dog is a hard charging dog, maybe independent. So it shows up a little bit under cooperation in a negative on natural ability. But those same dogs are the ones that are getting prize ones in utility because of that independence. Yeah. So, it's just the stages that they're in. and, you know, and how the handler can, you know, as a trainer, can bring that out of the dog.
Yeah. And I mean, looking at it from, you know, your personal hunting dog aspect from it, there's a big difference between having that natural ability level dog for the rest of its life versus that utility trained and or tested dog with you for the rest of its life as your hunting buddy. Can you go into that a little bit of what that looks like for people and, you know, a little bit incentive of why it would be good to consider testing?
I think overall it's going to give you a better hunting dog. If you're able to put them through, it takes a lot of pressure too on a dog to get to the point where you feel they're confident to run them in a utility test. And some dogs can take the pressure and some can't. And that's, again, I'd like to go back to work with your NABDA chapters and work with your breeders. As a breeder myself of German Shorthairs, when I talk to people that have puppies from me and they're getting ready for that utility or UPT test, I work with them. And it's amazing to me how many people say after they train for the utility test, even if their dog isn't quite ready that year, how much better they are in the field and the bond that they build with their dog, because you're out there and you're teaching your dogs to retrieve. You're teaching your dogs to be steady. You're teaching your dogs to be independent and go on a duck search. And again, that all carries over to the field. And I see such a connection as a handler and a breeder when people take their dogs and get them ready for utility. And again, I want to stress, people that train for utility, it doesn't mean that you have to test for it. A test shows where you're at within the standard. But there's a lot of people out there too that want to train for the utility test and not even test because they just want a really good hunting dog. And I think that's what this test is putting out there for people and for breeders, is to see what kind of hunting dog they are. Because in the end, that's all what we really, our ultimate goal. If you look at the NABDA calendar, generally for the Midwest where I'm from, you know, there's no NABDA tests after the Invitational in September, or very few, because people are getting ready and they're going hunting because that's what they've trained all summer for. So I really think it's key that when people are getting ready for the test and they're working with their chapters and they're working with their breeders, that people understand that this is all going to carry over into the woods or into the marsh. And again, I can't stress, and I speak for my own dogs, the bond that we build, it's truly magnificent, really. I mean, and I can tell when I train my dog for utility and my husband trains a dog for utility, you can tell whose dog they actually belong to by that point. We say they're our dogs, but when we're getting ready for utility, you know, my Zoe dog, she's with me. And she's looking to me, and when she's got something she's retrieving, she's going to come to me. And then that carries over into the hunting scenario as well. So when we shoot a bird and my husband shoots it, she brings it to me. So it's kind of cool that way, because again, we're transitioning from what we're getting ready for that utility test. And then we're taking it and that bond and heading out into the field with it.
All right. So let's talk through what a typical day of the utility test looks like. We're getting there around 6:30 in the morning, ish. I don't know. Perhaps that varies throughout the country. But how many people are going to be testing on that day in utility?
There's a sliding scale. So if it's a full utility test for the day, then there will be 6 utility dogs that will be tested.
Okay.
That's the maximum amount of dogs that can test in utility in one day.
Okay. Typically, we've always headed to the field first, but is there some variety there?
Generally, there is a variety. It really depends, again, the location, where everything is. And there's a lot of chapters that run double tests. And if you're using the same field, if you're a chapter that's lucky enough to have multiple fields, generally, again, this is each judging team will make up their decision how they're going to start the day. But if you're running a double test and say you're going to run it and there's only one field that two teams are running it. So a double test is meaning you're going to, one team will have six utility dogs or a mix of utility, natural ability, and the same with a second team. So you have six judges, three judges on each team. Well, the senior judge from each team is going to decide the order of the test. And if there's only one field they're working on, you can only have one team at a time at the field. So you're going to have, say, team A start with their field work and team B will go start with their water work. And then at lunchtime, it crosses. And again, the senior judges will talk to each other and how they're going to lay it out. So I would say generally, you know, in the Midwest, we like to try to start in the field before it gets too hot, but it's not always advantageous to do it that way. It just really depends what we have for our water, what we have for our field, what kind of travel is involved. And that's up to the judging team to lay that test out and how that's going to be. And in the morning, the senior judge and the judging team will announce the order of events throughout the day. But most likely, you know, you can expect to start in the field, but not always.
Okay.
The weather has a, you know, plays into it also. We deal with fog, you know, if it's going to rain, sometimes we'll do, you know, and then clear up later in the day. Sometimes we'll do the water work first because the rain doesn't impact things as much as, you know, having wet birds in the field. So that also plays into the judge's decision as to what events they're going to run at what time.
Okay. All right. For the means of the podcast format here, let's start out with the field portion first. And tell us a bit about what that looks like and what you're looking for as judges.
So the search is 30 minutes in the field. You know, the handler has a gun, but they're not shooting the birds. We have designated two shooters. So when the dog goes on point, the handler will position the shooters to the area where the dog or where the bird's going to be flushed for the dog. We're looking for, you know, the dog to be productive. It really, some people have this notion that the dog should be running big and covering a lot of ground, and that's not necessarily true. We look at production. You know, is the dog hitting the objectives that are out in the field in front of them and being productive? So, you know, that's when you're looking at what a dog is doing on the search and how we're scoring it. One of the big things that we look at is just, you know, how productive they are, how independent they are. It's not really how big the dog runs.
Okay. As far as, so you guys are, you're judging for the search in that, you're judging for pointing, steadiness. What do those things have? What do they have to look like?
Yeah. So pointing, we're looking for, you know, pointing begins when we're convinced that there's a point established. So judgment begins and ends when the dog is aware of the handler. So once the dog goes on point, we're looking for a solid point. And again, like I said, for the Natural Ability podcast, dogs, different breeds point differently. There might be a different tail set. You know, they might wag the tail a little bit. That stuff's okay, but we're looking for a convincing point in the field. We don't want to see the back end moving a bunch. We don't want to see the head moving around. A little bit of wagging is okay, but we're looking for a convincing point where the judging team in their heads can go, yep, there's a bird there. So we're looking for that point in the field. As far as the search goes, the search is, again, being productive, but also, is the dog expanding? Is it getting independent? For me personally, I like to look at a field and I draw a box. And did the dog hit different areas with outside of my box and hit different and new areas and hunting independently in their search when I'm judging search? So that's kind of what I'm looking for in the search. and the pointing. I would like to say that we do, when you get out into the field, generally, you know, we plant new birds every single time. So if you're a first time handler and you're going out there, I've had a lot of people ask me, well, how many birds are out there? Well, we're going to seed the field with at least 6 birds. So mean that first dog that heads out there, we're going to talk to our bird planters and tell them to put out at least 6 birds. After that, then each handler will get new birds put out. It may be probably 4 to 5. Again, each judging team does it differently, but we want to make sure that the dogs have every opportunity to get into birds. And your field search is going to show that when they're starting to be productive. So people understand there's always new birds put out for you. That's part of your entry fee. There's been many times where I've had people say to me, is there even birds out here? We make sure that there's birds out there every single time. You know, we're looking at the dog's overall steadiness. So once they make game, what generally will happen is the dog will go on point. We'll ask the handlers to position their gunners. So they're going to have 2 gunners, like Dan said. Generally, they position them 1 on each side. We're very, very careful to be safe because this is live ammo. So we generally will make sure that we're flushing the bird away from any gallery, away from any type of person. And our gunners are instructed to only take safe shots. So when it gets to that point and the dog goes on point and is aware of the handler, then pointing stops. We stop judging pointing at that point and it goes to steadiness. When we're going to the utility part of it, again, utility is that 30 minutes. A quick difference, UPT will only be 25 minutes. Pointing is judged the same way in UPT or utility. When we get to the steadiness part, that's when you as a handler are going to go in and flush the bird. So remember, your gunners are on each side of you generally, where you instructed them to. You have generally a chapter gun or a gun you brought yourself. You cannot have ammunition. You do not shoot the bird yourself. You should not have any ammo on you at all. But you will simulate that you are shooting the bird. And that is part of the steadiness sequence in the utility and the utility prep test. So when you go in to flush that bird, you're going to go in and you're going to flush the bird, and hopefully your dog will still stand there, and that's steady to, you know, the wing. Once you flush that bird up, then we want to make sure that you swing on the bird and the gunners are going to go ahead and shoot the bird. Once they shoot the bird and the bird falls, you're going to release your dog. So what I'm saying is you need your dog to be steady to shot, wing, and fall. Okay, so as soon as you flush the bird up, it's going to flush up. You're going to pretend to shoot it. The gunners will shoot it. Your dog has to stand through that entire sequence, and that's part of the steadiness. And then you're going to release your dog for the retrieve, and then that's another part of a judging of the field work. So steadiness sometimes is very confusing for people. And a utility test, again, is they're steady to the flush, so you're going to kick the bird up, steady to the wing, it's flying in the air, steady to the shot, so the gunners shoot, and your dog still has to be standing there, and then steady to the fall. What I do like to tell handlers is, this, again, just like natural ability, the cool part about NAVDA is let's say that first bird just doesn't go as well as planned. You can make it up as you go. And I like to tell handlers as well, if you know that there's going to be a problem, use your commands early and make them count, because that will carry through the rest of your bird contacts in the field, which will help your steadiness score throughout the rest of that 30 minutes. Now for UPT, steadiness is a little bit different. The dogs can break on the shot, so they still have to be steady through the flush and the wing. But as soon as the gunner shoots the bird, the UPT dog can break. A utility dog cannot break. Okay. And the big thing as well as handlers for UPT and utility is remember to swing on your bird. As judges, we'll remind you if you forget. I forget. It happens all the time. But if we have to remind you after the second and third time, and that may even be a little excessive for some judges, it is going to affect your overall steadiness score. So there's a lot there.
Yeah. So, and because I'm just thinking, like, you know, with all the nervousness of being out there and testing your dog, you know, you just forget to do that part of the swinging on the bird, mounting, you know, that type of scenario. And I will get docked for that if I forget.
After a certain point, we're going to remind you that first time, no. Even the second time, maybe not. And then the second time I will say, okay, I reminded you once, you know, I'm going to remind you again the next time. It's going to affect your overall steadiness score.
Okay.
Yeah. A lot of times too, as a judge, you know, I'll remind the handler when they're going into flush. If this, you know, if I've already seen that this might be an issue, if they're excited, and most times the handler is so worried about their dog moving that they're not thinking about swinging on the gun, but I'll say that to the individual. Make sure you swing on the bird when you flush, you know, just before they're going into flush. So hopefully it reminds them to do that, so you don't run into the situation where you're constantly having to tell them to do it.
I mean, is there a certain amount that we can keep in mind, or how often are we allowed to talk to the dogs? How many commands can we give? You know, I think one of the tests I was at, someone that field trial came in and ran a dog in utility, and in horseback field trials, we're used to what we refer to as singing to our dogs, you know, when they're out there so that they know where we are. And so there's a lot of kind of talking and hacking per se. So making that transition to this venue, that was something brand new for that handler, of not being able to really have that communication with the dog. Can you touch on what's kind of allowed and frowned upon?
I think what you're referring to a lot of times is when, you know, the field trialers are trying to push their dogs out. Obviously you don't want your dog to leave the bird field. So you would handle your dog like you would if you're hunting. If you want to go to the left, you can give a command and go to the left. If you want to go to the right, you can give a command and go to the right. If you think the dog needs to come in for, you know, for any reason, you can call them. Where it starts to become an issue is if the dog's not really keen in on you and we're following the dog around and the hacking part of it gets excessive. The other portion, I think, where some people, you know, might get hit on, you know, talking too much is the actual pointing, steadiness, and the sequence of the retrieve. When the dog's on point, you really shouldn't have to say anything to the dog. They should be steady throughout. Like Angie mentioned, though, if the dog is not standing there and is breaking at some point, you know, a couple commands early on that maybe the first bird or second bird sometimes corrects that. When the dog's on point, you really shouldn't have to say anything to the bird until you're asking them, or you really shouldn't say anything to the dog until you're asking the dog to retrieve the bird. The other part, when the bird is shot, you release the dog. The dog goes out for the retrieve itself. When the dog picks up the bird, you can give a good boy, or, you know, we want to make sure that everything is positive out there as much as possible. But so, you know, somebody that has to call the dog to come back to them with the bird, that's different than just, you know, a, hey, good boy or good girl. When the dog picks up the bird, and on the retrieve itself, we want the dog to go up, you know, straight out, straight back. We don't want it to veer left or right. We want to come and present the bird to the handler. Rule of thumb that we kind of look at is the dog presents the bird to the handler within one step, and all 4 feet have stopped moving. So you don't want the dog to run by you and have to reach out and grab it, or go behind you and then come back. Like, those are all things that could impact the score. Ideally, you give the command, the dog runs right out, picks up the bird. You can say, good boy, good girl, blow the whistle, whatever. Have the dog come back, present the bird to you, you know, stop in front of you, all 4 feet, stop, present the bird, you grab the bird, and that would be considered a good retrieve.
Okay. Can I, let's say, maybe the first bird my dog broke on the flush, and that in that second one, if I see that kind of happening through body language, can I give him a gentle whoop? Or is that gonna hurt me?
You can give that command, but it will be a ding on your steadiness score.
Okay.
But if you need it, give it, because again, you could make it up for that next bird. Okay. So, you know, we look at all those different areas when we're looking at the steadiness and, you know, the whole steadiness to flush and wing. And, you know, so if you're going in for the flush and let's say you go, you knew you had a problem before and you go, generally people say, whoa, you're going to probably in that part of the study to flush, you will get a ding. But if your dog is steady through the wing and the shot in the fall, well, that makes up for that little whoa that you just did. So you saved yourself overall. So okay. Basically, like as judges, if on my scorecard, I would write down, if you said whoa before the flush, that bird, for just that bird, you're going to probably get, for me, you would get a 3. But then if your dog is steady for the wing, the shot in the fall, you'll get a 4, 4, and 4. Well, overall, that's going to average to a 4. So you saved yourself. So to me, that's smart handling, because you used a command when you, one, knew you needed it, and two, you made it count, and it made up for it throughout the rest of the sequence. And that's, as handlers, I've seen, really, they don't understand, maybe especially first-time handlers, that whole steadiness sequence. If you can stop that dog from breaking, that's going to help you. So you're going in for that flush, and all of a sudden the dog is starting to dance around. Give that strong whoa. If it was my dog, I would, because generally when they're dancing, they're going to start breaking. So if you give that whoa, it can save you. It can help you. And then let's say the bird flushes and your dog keeps going, and then you yell whoa really loud and you stop the dog, that helps you. So again, when we say use those commands when you need them, those are situations when you might need them. And you might need to hack on them. It's going to hurt you a little bit, but it's also going to help you in the end.
So let's walk out that scenario one more step. That third bird I get to. So first bird he broke on. Second bird, I gave him that whoop. Third bird, completely clean. How is that going to completely take me back to fours?
For that sequence, for that bird, you would have a 4. But okay, Let's say the other two, the one they completely took out, the second one you got a little bit better, and the third one was great. That's going to just help increase your score versus bring it down.
Like in our training days, I think it's important, and I don't think a lot of people do this enough, is you really should know the scorecard. This is going to help you as a handler tremendously, because in order to get a prize one utility, which everybody, that's what they're trying to do, there's areas that you don't have to get a 4 overall in the score. You can get a 3. So getting back to kind of what we've talked about and what Angie just mentioned, sometimes you have to give a command, but that command is only going to knock you down to a 3. And, you know, that's still within the running of a prize one for a lot of the categories. Steadiness is one of them. So you don't have to get a 4 in steadiness in the field. You can get a 3. So if you have to say something in order to have your dog perform, then, you know the scorecard. Same thing with healing. I see a lot of handlers, they don't say anything at all, and then their dog either goes around a gate, you know, misses a gate, or something happens. Whereas if they would have just given that one command, it might have straightened it out, and they still get a 3, and they, you know, they still are in the running to get a prize one, you know, for the overall evaluation. So I just want to stress that know that scorecard, know where you have to get a four, like the duck search, and know where you can maybe get a three in some of the areas like steadiness or retrieve of the shot bird.
Okay. Let's go on to the drag. So the drag is typically a duck is used for that. But you allow people to bring fur, right?
If they have it with them, yes, they can bring. Yes, they can bring fur. The chapter does not supply that. So when generally the chapters are figuring out your entry fee, they're figuring out a duck for your duck drag. So you've paid for that, but it's generally a freshly killed duck that we take. We pull some feathers on it. We lay it down on the ground, those feathers, and you and your dog are out of sight. And generally then the judge will drag that. I like to count out about 100 yards, so about 100 paces with a hook in it, meaning it might take a curve. So what we're trying to simulate is a wounded duck that crawls up on shore and lays down and dies. Does your dog have the obedience, one, to get away from you? So when you say retrieve, so it's desire there too as well. So when you bring your dog in, it's going to be kind of like the NA track. So you're going to get your dog focused on that feather pile. There is going to be another judge at the end of that drag. So they'll either drag the fur that you supplied, meaning like if you have a dead raccoon or a dead rabbit, generally we will drag it for you, but you as a handler have to bring that with you. That is not supplied by the chapter. The chapter supplies a duck, and ducks are pretty stinky. I like to say it's like a highway, you know, to a bird, because those ducks stink so bad that I practically can smell them. So again, we're going to lay a feather pile for you. We're going to drag that duck about 100 yards with a hook. And then the judge is going to put that bird down and it's going to go hide behind a tree to see what your dog does out of your sight. How do they handle that task? So you're bringing your dog in and you may say track, you may say fetch. I personally say fetch. And when your dog is locked in on that feather pile and is moving forward, you go ahead and you let the dog go and you just stand there and wait. And generally you don't see the dog do the duck drag. And it's a lot of obedience. You know, you're telling the dog that you need them to do a certain task, and that's to bring you back that dead duck. So it's a lot of obedience and cooperation. Obedience is going out, cooperation is coming back. So when you send them out there and they go pick up that duck, what do they do with it? You know, there's sometimes where dogs aren't used to the judge on the other side. So you want to practice that. Have a friend drag a duck for you. Have a chapter member drag a duck for you. So your dog is used to somebody being on that other end. We try to hide and get out of sight, but generally the dogs, they've got pretty good noses. They're going to find you. So once they get on that duck, then they're supposed to pick the duck up and bring it directly back to you. Okay. And we don't want to see a drive-by where we talked about in the field where Dan said, you know, they're bringing the bird back and it runs back towards behind you. It parades. It says to everybody, hey, look at my duck. Look at my duck. That dog has to come directly to you and present the bird, and you take the bird from the dog. And so drags, I've seen some issues in is people are just not practicing it with their dogs. They're not getting their dogs used to somebody being on the other end of that drag. And then them coming back. Sometimes if dogs are really ticked off for the day, because again, there's a lot of pressure, you're going to mostly see it, or yeah, most of the time you'll see it. For me, I've seen it in the drag. Because those dogs are ticked off. They've had a lot of pressure from the test day. Maybe they can sense your nerves. And I've seen dogs eat the duck. I've seen dogs bury the duck. I've seen dogs pee on the duck. And I've seen all of the above. So you want to make sure that you're practicing this. And it's a fine line, just like the natural ability track. You don't want to overdo it as well. But please make sure you're exposing your dogs to the drag. There's a lot of people that don't. And there, again, going back to your question with fur, there's people that, again, you can use fur, but we don't see it a lot. Generally, we're using a freshly dispatched duck. So
where I have seen using fur the most is dogs that test in both some of the German systems and they're in NAVDA. And so they're training for that and they just want to stay consistent. So they do use fur for that. The other thing about the training part for this, you know, technology has advanced so much so that when you're training for this, a lot of times, so the handler can actually see what their dog does when they're out of sight. Sometimes we just FaceTime each other. And so the person that drags the duck and then gets out of sight is, you know, has it on their phone and they're FaceTiming, you know, when you're training. So the handler can actually see what the dog does when it's out of their sight, because a lot of times, you know, they don't believe what the dog is doing. And some of the things that Angie mentioned, they certainly go on, and this gives you some perspective so you can, you know, do a better job training if you do have some of those issues. So, you know, using the technology that we have today certainly improves being able to get a good score, especially in this part of the test.
That's a good point, Dan. We've used our, when we've just been training by ourselves, we'll even put like the GoPro camera on right. That other side. Can you explain, when people are trying to prepare for this, what is a typical pattern or distance that they should be practicing on? How many turns? Are they sharp? Can you walk us through that?
So when the dog, when you're practicing it, you want to make sure you do at least one sharp turn. And for utility, again, we're going 100 yards or more. And for UPT, we're only going about 50 yards. Okay. So it's half the distance for UPT. Again, this is utility prep. For utility, it's the full 100 yards with a slight bend in it. And then again, I want to stress too that when the dog is bringing the bird back to you, the dog has to come all the way back to you and has to present until you take it from them. So I've seen a lot of dogs, and you know, we're kind of going into some training tips, which I think is very helpful, that these dogs, again, do drive-bys, and they're doing, and drive-bys means they're running past you. They're not coming to you specifically with the bird. That's what we're looking for. So when you're practicing this, have people around you. Have a couple chapter members or a couple friends around you. So dogs are used to simulating the judges. And teach that dog that they have to retrieve that bird directly to you and not to somebody else. So that's something good to do when you're practicing. And again, UPT, the distance is just cut in half, but we're still looking for that retrieve. It doesn't have to be quite as clean for UPT. UPT, they just have to come within a reach of the handler, but utility, it has to be clean and presented. And that can be the dog sits in front of you, it heels alongside of you, but it comes up next to you and you're able to take the game from them. And then that's when that the judging for the UT drag ends. And again, UPT is just, it's a little bit less that we're looking for. As long as the bird is within one step of you, you can take one step, reach over and grab the duck from the dog for a UPT drag. For a utility drag, it has to be clean.
I know sometimes there's questions about how much can I handle the dog in regards to the drag, and the drag is out of sight of where the handler releases the dog. So usually like within the last like 50 yards, you might be able to see the dog. So there's really not the opportunity to do that. Because the way that we do the drag is we're testing the obedience. So most of the time, the dog's out of sight. So you really don't have the opportunity to give any kinds of commands because you don't usually see the dog until they're coming back, you know, with the bird.
Okay. What if you as a handler knows, because you've been watching the other people go, you know, have an idea of where that duck's being put, where if you can tell that your dog is not tracking or has gotten off the track, can you kind of work it like a blind retriever or retriever drill where you're throwing your arm out there to the right and telling them to fetch that
well,
way?
Any command after you release the dog to make the retrieve, you're going to be subject to a downgrade after that.
Okay.
And don't think of the natural ability track. The dog is tracking the scent of the bird. You know, here we have a dead duck and you have a judge dragging the bird. Sometimes there's an apprentice judge with them. So now you have two humans walking and the bird. So the tracking aspect of it isn't as crucial as natural ability. The dog runs out, and if they're downwind and they lose the track and come back into the bird, that's fine. You know, it's not, they don't have to follow the track of where the bird had been drugged, specifically like you would in natural ability. It's more of an obedience drill than it is, you know, a natural ability where they're actually tracking the foot scent of the pheasant.
Mm-hmm. How important is it that they're following that line of the drag real close, or can they do a circle around and come back to it and they'll still get, a higher score?
Yeah, as long as it's
not as crucial.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, as long as it's within a reasonable time as well. You know, so when you're letting the dog go and let's say they cast off behind you or they take a far cast right, but then once they get back on the scent track and they start doing forward motion or forward progress, that's okay. When it gets excessive and they just go into a full search and they're just looking and looking and they just can't get on that track, the judging team may tell you to call your dog back and restart them. That will bring your score down if that happens. But generally the judging team's going to give you enough time to let your dog refocus, because sometimes it's just a bad start. Who knows which way, you know, the wind might shift. But as long as it's within a reasonable time, but once you let that dog go on the duck drag, you really can't say anything until they come all the way back to you and you're reaching down to grab the bird and you say give or release or whatever your out command is for the bird.
In the field portion, the only time you can really get your hands on the dog is after a bird contact. I highly suggest that people, whether the dog is thirsty or not, it's your chance to calm the dog down and you can give your dog water. I hear a lot of handlers say, well, I don't think my dog is hot. And I don't know that that's necessarily the point all the time. A lot of it is just calming the dog down before you start rolling again and trying to get into the next bird, get the feathers out of their mouth. So I don't know that the handlers take advantage of that aspect of the field portion and what you're allowed to do, as much as maybe they could. I always give my dog water, regardless of the temperature, the weather, you know, outside, after each bird contact, because it's my chance to calm the dog down a little bit. The other aspect too, that I would just want to mention is what Angie had mentioned about going to a utility test or a UPT test. You can always ask the handler if you can walk along, you know, with the judges just to view it. And I would suggest that if you are new to this, that you, that you do that. A lot of times you can't see from the gallery view, you know, where everybody is, you know, where the starting point is. You can't see what's going on. But if you walk with the judges, a lot of times you can see what's going on in the field, and that really helps you become a better trainer and a better handler.
Yeah. And to add to that, Dan, if you know how to bird plant or have somebody teach you how to bird plant, that's a great way to be able to help out and learn both at the same time. And usually you have a better view of what's going on in the field being a bird planter because you're somewhere else off to the side.
Yeah, and the whole water thing as well, there's so many people are like, can I call my dog and give him water? Absolutely. please give your dogs water. We don't want anything to happen to you. Make sure you have water for yourself or your dog, especially if it's a hot day and we're getting into those hot days now here in the Midwest. Water your dog. And like Dan said, it's a time for you to reconnect with your dog. There's going to be tubs out there. Judges are going to lead you to the tub. The judge may say to you, well, how about we go over to a water tub, you know, and dogs with their tongue wide out and hanging, practically dragging on the ground, they're having a hard time smelling. So you want to take that time. We have 30 minutes for utility and 25 minutes for UPT. This is your time, and we're going to spend that entire time out there. So taking a few minutes to water your dog is okay. Calling your dog and telling him a good boy, good girl, giving him a little pat on the side is okay. But we don't want to see any training situations. So if your day just didn't go quite as well as you were hoping in the field, we don't want to see you handling your dog, picking him up, saying, whoa. I will say again, make sure that your dog only has one collar on them throughout the entire test day. No shock collars are allowed during the test time. If your dog has a Seresto collar, that's fine, but it's generally a buckled collar, and that's it. And no treats. Please don't bring treats in the field with you. This is a utility test. These are more advanced dogs. We don't even accept treats for natural ability. So for new handlers, that's stuff to try to just keep in your head and keep reminding yourself of things that you can and you can't bring with yourself with to a utility test.
Good stuff to add there, Angie. All right, let's go on to the water portion. And let's see, kick it off with my favorite part of the entire utility test, the duck search. I like to see the dogs with the grit.
In this part of the test, it's really the handler sits back and watches their dog. I mean, that's really what it is. You bring your dog up to the water's edge. Prior to that, the judges have pulled the flying feathers out of the duck and released the duck in an area usually downwind from where the launch point is for the dog. Sometimes it's 75 yards away. Sometimes it's 100. Sometimes it's 50. It really depends how big the pond is. So the duck swims out of sight. The dog is brought up to the launch site, and the handler fires a shot and sends their dog for the search. Now, the important part to remember is the dog does not have to recover the duck. It just has to be active in searching for the duck. And what the judges are looking for is independence. If the dog is looking at the objectives that are out there in front of them and checking them. So, some ponds have cattails, some ponds have small little islands, you have lily pads, just different things that, the dog is looking at to determine, could a duck be hiding here? And you want to see the dog expand their search. We use that a lot, that term a lot when we're talking as judges about expansion. Independence is another term that we use when we're describing, when we're writing down on our scorecards and describing the dog search. Did the dog run the bank before, back and forth on the bank, or did they deliberately go in the water after the shot and just, keep swimming out and expanding and looking for the duck? That's what we really want to see. There's no real set time. We kind of have a unwritten rule about the 10-minute search, but water is a little bit harder to find out here in Arizona and in some of the areas like Nevada and in Utah. So we have had situations where dogs have just done a bang up job and they've searched the whole pond and there's just nothing more to search. And it's under that 10-minute mark. So we've called the dog back. Now, there's a minimum that we have as far as it should be at least a 2-acre pond in size or bigger. So we do have that to kind of keep things as consistent as possible. But, there's various parts of the country and it differs. When I lived in New York and I was in the upstate New York and in the Finger Lakes chapter, our duck search pond was over 100 acres. And here in the Phoenix area, it's 2 acres. So you have those differences that we have to deal with. But primarily you're looking for independence, expansion, and the dog not to quit on you, not to come back to the handler and stand there. We want to see the dog continuously looking and really not come back until the dog is called. The judges will tell the handler when they've seen enough and, give the handler the command to call the dog. And hopefully, the dog has been searching that whole time and comes back to the handler. The deduction usually starts when either the dog catches the duck and comes back and maybe doesn't go back out for the resend. There is not a second shot, so the dog has to just go out there. Or if the dog is on, has found the duck and the judges have the opportunity to shoot the duck, now the dog is retrieving the dead duck, comes back to the handler, and the dog doesn't go back out on the resend. That's usually where a deduction is. Or if the dog comes back early, before the judges really have seen enough of to determine that the dog has a 4 score, usually get deductions that way too.
Yeah. When I give my instructions to handlers for the utility duck search, generally what I do is I bring them up to the water's edge. I tell them that there's a wounded duck out there and we want your dog to go out and search for that wounded duck. So you're going to bring your dog up to the edge of the water. You're going to tell them to whoa, sit, stay, whatever your stay command would be. I say whoa. We're going to tell you as judges which direction to shoot. So you're going to shoot a blank firearm. So you're going to So you're going to shoot a blank shell and it's going to be positioned over the water. So you're simulating you shot a duck, but your dog never saw the duck fall. Your dog is supposed to take a slight pause and then you release your dog. So basically you bring your dog up to the water's edge. You tell them to whoa. You load that blank shell into your gun, you aim over the water and you shoot and you go ahead and release your dog. And like Dan said, then we're just looking for expansion. We're looking for the desire to do the task that you ask them to do. And if your dog is out there and finds the duck, it just depends how long did it take them to do that. If some dogs find it within a minute or two, well, it's hard for us as judges to judge search in a dog if they go right out and come right back. Because sometimes these are live ducks for utility. So for utility, they're live ducks. For UPT, it is a dead duck. And I'm going to go into a little bit of the differences with UPT duck search. But the utility duck search is a live duck. And sometimes those ducks will swim right out in sight of the dog. You release them, they know what they're after, and they see that duck and they go get it. And your dog brings the duck back. So the dog has to bring that duck back to you. We don't want to see the dog grab the duck and run off in the woods. That's happened, and bury it or eat it. That's a very bad thing. Your dog needs to bring that duck back to you. If it's within that minute or two where we just have not been able to judge the search of your duck search for your dog, we'll say, okay, handler, go ahead and resend your dog. And you have to resend your dog without a shot. So you grab the duck from your dog and you say fetch, or what I like to use is go get the ducky, because I like them to be excited to do the task. So I will set them back up, and we want to see that dog go out there then and expand on their search. So this is search for the duck. And sometimes dogs are out there and they're searching and they find the duck. No problem. Your judging team will tell you what they want you to do. We'll say either leash up your dog or resend them. It's just, again, if we had enough time to judge that search of the duck with the dog. And then the other part of it is for UPT. So UPT, we do use a dead duck. Your dog can break on the shot. So when you're bringing them up for UPT, there'll be a dead duck out there. So it can't swim out in front of the dog. It gives them a chance to start their search. And what will happen is you're going to shoot the gun. And your dog, if they're standing there, great, release them, but they don't have to. They can break. For utility, they have to stay there. For UPT, they can break and they can go out and do their search. Let's say they find that dead duck, they bring it back to you, and the judging team needed a little bit more time to see search in your dog. They'll ask you to do a resend, and you can do a resend with a shot for UPT, for the utility prep test. For UT, you cannot. So that's just a little bit of the differences between utility and UPT. And again, anywhere in the country that you go, duck search is going to be a little bit different. The cover might be a little bit different. There might be bogs out there. So make sure you're practicing in different areas. So when I practice for utility duck search, I probably go to 3 or 4 different ponds because you never know. You might have an idea what the chapter is going to use. And if, especially if you don't get a chance to practice on the test pond that they're using, practice in different areas so your dogs aren't used to that exact same area and that exact same bog and that exact same cattail slough. Because if you keep doing the same thing, when you get to that new place, it may not go as well. So put some variety in your training as well.
I think we could have a whole new episode on training for the duck search.
Yeah. You know, and it's hard. You know, we struggled with our own dog with it last year. You know, we kept getting that 3 in duck search and you need a 4. And if you are going for that prize 1, which everybody trains for it, you need a 4 in duck search. And we had a hard time with our girl just getting away from us, having that independence, that desire. She was a young dog. She was just 2 years old. To feel confident enough to get away from us, to get out there. And it's hard to train for by yourself. You want to be with a chapter. You want to be with your breeder. You want to be with a team, with people that can help you out there, because it is difficult. And it does take some time for dogs to get it. And some dogs, just the light bulb turns on right away. They're just like, I got it. No problem. And other dogs, it takes a lot of ducks to get them to that point, to get out that independence, to expand, to search, to have that desire. You know, obedience is going out. You tell them to fetch, cooperation is coming back. So when you call them, they come back to you. Or if they have a duck, they're cooperative and they come back to you. Again, with any part of this test, go watch a utility or a UPT duck search. It will give you a good idea what's going on. And go to a handler's clinic. There's handler's clinics all over the nation. Go on the NAVDA website and find a handler's clinic, because we go through that. We demonstrate it. You know, Dan and I are sitting here today talking to you about different ways on how to run the test. But until you can visualize it, I think it will really connect with what we're trying to say. And the only way to visualize that is, again, go to a test or go to a handler's clinic, because a handler's clinic is going to give you that opportunity in every testing situation to see what it's like. And you actually get a judge's scorecard. So you fill it out with a judge. There's a senior judge that's an approved clinic leader that will run this and walk you through the entire process of a utility and a UPT test.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, I'm curious if you guys agree with this, but I find the duck search portion to be the most difficult part to train for. You know, if the dog doesn't have that instinct, have that innate independence and drive to be able to get out there and just keep searching after they hear that shot, or even if you have a resend and there is no shot, just to have that drive of, I'm not going to give up until I come back with something. That's not, I think there's that transition, you know, that we say in the field where you can pull them in, but you can't push them out, where it transfers right, same kind of concept to the water. And, you know, in training days, I'm finding so many people are doing really unique things to try to train for this. I've even seen some put bowls of dog food at different bogs throughout the pond, trying to get the dog to go there, and or hiding ducks under a bucket in different quadrants of the pond. And I mean, do you guys agree? And is this why it's maybe scored out so heavily, because because you want to see that type of a dog in this venue and in advanced training?
I think, you know, I agree. I've seen all kinds of stuff like you're talking about for training this, but I can just speak from my, you know, my own experience, and nothing has helped me with the duck search like actually taking my dog duck hunting.
Right.
After a season of duck hunting, I really haven't had problems with the duck search because they're so excited. You know, I can't, you know, a lot of times they'll bust down the side of my blind to go get ducks when I'm duck hunting. And then that excitement just transfers over because they know what's going on. And not everybody likes to duck hunt. I get it. But, I just think that if you are struggling a little bit with the duck search, that's a great way to have fun. It's, you know, and you're not putting pressure on the dog. And then the other thing, which, I found is, I used to do a lot of talking about pushing the dog back out and everything. You know, I did the old throwing the rocks, which is terrible. I don't suggest that at all. So with deeper ponds, I use a kayak, and if the dog's coming back, I'll get in my kayak and I'll just won't say anything. I'll just go out and I'll always put a duck somewhere where I know where it is. And I'll just kind of push the dog into that area. And then eventually they realize that, you know, that there is something out here. I shouldn't have quit too early. The other thing, fortunately here, which has been awesome for the duck search for our chapter, is we have, again, it's a pond that's 2 acres. But it's about, maybe a little bit deeper than waist deep. And so we have everybody in waders. And if the dog's coming back, we walk out there, and it's just like the field, you know, you're pushing the dog back out into the field, and not all the bodies of water. You can do that because they're too deep, but this particular body of water is perfect for the duck search because you can walk out there and the dog is acting like they're in the field with you. So then all of a sudden they get out in front of you again, and you push them into areas where, you know, you have a duck, or you take a duck with you and you plan it strategically so they can find it. But I agree, you know, this is a higher level, and the dogs that do well are very independent. And sometimes you have to build that up in a dog.
Mm-hmm. Dan, can you just talk for a second? You mentioned the throwing the rocks technique, and mention why you don't recommend that.
Well, because because then the dog is depending on you. So what will start happening is then they're looking for a splash, or they're looking at you and you're signaling them to go somewhere, you know, where the splash is. So all of a sudden they focus back in on the bank. And I don't like to have the dog focusing on the bank. I want them on the far shore or the cattails across the way. I always want them focused out. I never plant any ducks on the shoreline where I'm training from. So if I'm launching the dog, you know, from, let's say, the east bank, I'll only plant ducks on the, you know, the west side of the pond, or, you know, or to the left or to the right. I don't want the dog ever searching or being able to find a duck on the shoreline where I'm launching from. So that teaches them to always go out. And the stimulation that you're giving them by throwing rocks is they're focusing on you. They see the throwing motion, and then all of a sudden they're depending on you instead of them on their own seeking out where the duck is.
Essentially bringing them into you when your objective is to push them out.
Yeah. Cause what will happen is they'll start to swim and tread water in place and be looking at you and waiting for you to give them the signal of where to go. And it leads to a bunch of issues down the road. And so I just wouldn't suggest even starting off doing that.
Yeah. And I would suggest too, when you're training for this, don't be afraid to put a bunch of ducks out. We like to say we seed the field. You want your dog to be successful every time. So like what Dan was saying, if a dog is coming back because it just doesn't think there's a duck out there, lead them to that duck with your boat. Make sure that they know every single time that there's a duck out there and it's successful. And you may have to get them excited. Don't be afraid. You know, birds make a bird dog. Ducks are not cheap. They're not cheap in the Midwest area here. Unless you raise them yourself, and even then they're not real cheap. But if you're committed to this and to training your dog and getting them ready either for the test or a hunting scenario, use ducks. And you may have to shoot a duck for the dog to get them excited in your initial training, to get them excited to expand out there. You know, when we're starting, we let the dogs see a duck and we let them go on a chase. And then we reward them with a kill. So we'll kill the duck and let them retrieve it. And when we're practicing this, again, you want to make sure that the dog is always successful. It never comes back to shore when you're training without a duck. That way in the test, they know that they have to stay out there and keep searching till they find that duck for you. And another training technique for the duck search that I like to do personally is when I first start out is I prepare for that resend right away. So in a resend for utility, you can't use a shot. So when I first start out, I send the dog without a shot. I say fetch and then usually give them a visual to get them to expand, to go to the other side of the shore, to get to that bog, to search that pond, wherever you may be. And then generally, as we get closer to the test and their desire amps up more and they know their objective, I'll take away that visual because you won't have a visual in the test. But that visual in the beginning is to get them excited and to make sure that they're always successful. There's a lot of times when I'm judging and dogs are out there and their time is up and we've seen a search and we can't get that dog back because they've been trained. There's a duck out there. I just got to keep looking. Mm-hmm. And it takes a lot of encouragement. And sometimes it even takes the handler having to jump in the canoe or the kayak and go get their dog because their dog is so keen on doing that work for you and that bond that you've built with them and what you've taught them. And especially if you have had a duck hunting season, that they don't want to come back. And that's a good thing.
Are you going to get docked in score if you are calling your dog back in and it doesn't listen? Is that going to be a cooperation ding?
Not for duck search. Okay. No, but we do need to get the dog back because we need to be able to run the next dog. But you won't get dinged in it, but we're going to do everything we can do to help you and be prepared yourself to jump in the boat and go get your dog if we tell you to do that.
Or if it's on a continuous chase of a duck, right? So,
you know, and that's another good point. So let's say you're in the duck search and we're only a few minutes in and your dog finds the bird and they start chasing and they're chasing. We're going to have to shoot that bird and your search stops. So the time or overall evaluation on the search of the duck stops once we know your dog is on game. So we want to make sure that we shoot that bird or the bird gets out of sight of the dog. There's a lot of times too, ducks are pretty maneuverable. They'll go an opposite way and the dog will lose track of them. And at that time, then we can watch how the dog reacts. Maybe the dog is using its nose and there is that portion in the duck search of the use of nose. And they pick up the scent on the water and how they use that to advance them beyond and continue searching. So, you know, we're trying to set up testing scenarios here and it doesn't always go the greatest, but the big thing is if that dog is out there searching and they get on a chase, if the duck goes in opposite direction, that's a good thing because you want your dog to reestablish. And then we start the clock again for searching mm-hmm. or, you know, we start our overall evaluation. But if we have to shoot that bird and we didn't really get a chance to judge your search, be prepared for that because we're going to ask you to do a resend. And that's why I like to, when I'm training, to practice a lot with sends without a shot, because I want those dogs to know when I say fetch or go get the ducky or hunt them up, that they know that they have to get away from me and they have to go find me a duck.
I want to go duck hunting with you and hear you say, go get the ducky.
I did it last year at the utility test with Zoe. I said to her was get going. I said, get going means get the heck out of here and get away from me and go find that duck. And she was so amped up. My first utility dog, I put so much pressure on her at duck search and she was starting to break down. It was 2 weeks before. And like anything, you can overdo it. And I had a chapter member pull me aside and say, Angie, it's not fun for Izzy anymore. You have to make it fun. Tell her to get the ducky. And that's how it started. I told her to get the ducky and she's like, what? What? And then I let her chase the ducky. And the next thing you know, at her utility test, 2 weeks later, I'm like, Izzy, get the ducky. And off she went. And she did a four duck search. So
that's awesome.
What works. Use what works.
So what happens when the dog brings back something other than a duck? Angie, you're familiar with, I don't know if Dan, you are, but the search grounds in Wisconsin, it's pretty deep. And then there's a wooded area behind there. And we had a dog come back with a raccoon. So how does that work for scoring?
As far as the them bringing back something that is a game animal, the judges, you're not going to be deducted. We would just kind of converse and decide, what next steps we would need. But in your situation where the person's coming back with, or the dog's coming back with a raccoon, well, that's a game animal if a dog trained for the German system, maybe that's why I came back with the raccoon, right? So we would have to just evaluate it accordingly. I've had some dogs catch rabbits because they've gone on to the other side of the pond and actually catch a rabbit and come back. And what we did is, we just had the dog go back out again. So now if it comes back with a stick or something, then that's maybe something the judges would have to talk on an individual basis to see the circumstance. But if it's a game animal, they probably would just, have the dog retrieve it and then send the dog back out.
Is there anything to add as far as the difference for UTP?
For the duck search, it's a dead duck, like Angie had mentioned, and usually it's put out maybe 50 yards on the upwind side of where the launch site is. That's really the major difference, and you still want the dog to search, but again, you're not looking for a utility duck search where they're tearing up the swamp. You have to take that into consideration. You still want them to expand, but it's maybe at a little bit lesser level than you're expecting for a utility dog, because UPT test is kind of that halfway step between natural ability and utility.
Okay. What about for the retrieve of the duck? Is that going to be expected the same as it was in the field?
Or
yes,
UPT?
The UPT, the retrieving of any kind of game animal for the UPT test, so the shot bird or the retrieve of the duck, it's the same thing. It doesn't have to be as polished as the utility test. However, they still have to bring the bird back within the vicinity of the handler so they can, reach out and grab it within a step or two.
Can you talk to the dog on that retrieve in the UTP more, giving them, can you get down on one knee and give them that?
No.
Come here.
No.
Okay.
No. No, you can give them a good boy, good girl, same thing. Okay. You have a little bit more latitude on the distance, whereas utility has to come right up to you and present it. You can maybe reach out for the UPT. You can reach out and grab it. And maybe the dog doesn't have to come to an absolute complete stop. Again, varying conditions, the judges have to judge what they're seeing, but just rule of thumb, that's probably the major difference. Utility, they have to come in and present the bird to the handler, and they should be stopped. They shouldn't be moving around. Whereas UPT, there's a little bit more latitude with that.
Okay. So moving over to the study by blind scenario, we have the healing portion. Well, first, is a heel required going down to the duck search?
No.
No.
Okay.
And okay. For the healing sequence for UPT, there are no healing stakes. It's just walking down to the blind itself, whereas you have some kind of slalom course or something for UPT, you don't have that utility. You do. Most chapters use the stakes where you have to weave in and out. I have seen some where they use natural kind of like, you know, trees and things that, and they cut a path through that and they use that. And that's really the difference between the two tests. For both tests, you're going down to the water for the retrieve of the thrown duck.
Okay. Yeah. On that retrieving portion. So walk me through that. So, as you arrive with your dog on a leash, you see a whole bunch of healing stakes in this weird little curving pattern. And mm-hmm. the judge is coming up to you and they're telling you what, and then you're doing what?
So the judge will ask the handler, do they want all the instructions now at the, you know, before the healing starts and before they get to the blind, or do they want, you know, the instructions for healing and the steadiness by blind. And then when they come back, for the distraction shots and then the retrieve of the duck. Some people want them all at once. Some people want them in segments. So what'll happen is, the person will give them the instructions. Let's say for the healing portion, you want a loose leash. It's good to have like a little bit of a loop, and, you don't want any tugging. You want the dog to be in front of you. You don't want, if the chapter is using healing stakes, you don't want them to go on the outside. You want that it to be a smooth transition. It's supposed to simulate walking down to a duck blind. You don't want the dog to run way ahead of you and blow out any of the ducks that might already be on the blind or on the water in front of the blind. So that's what the purpose is. So you're supposed to have a calm, quiet dog healing down to the water. And then once you get, so that when the judge gives you the instructions, and the handler tells their dog to heal, you're judging the dog all the way down until they get to the blind. And then that's when the healing portion stops. Now, again, UPT, there are no healing stakes, but, you know, it's the same thing. It's when the judge gives you the instructions to when you get to the blind by the water.
So in the UPT, if with no stakes, can they just walk a straight path then from point A to point B?
Well, most of the time it's more of a path that's to the water. So it's not necessarily straight. It's more of like a bending path.
Okay.
Yeah. And the healing is very important, like Dan said, but it also can equate to the field. Again, we're simulating hunting situations. When I do a lot of cattail slough hunting in North Dakota, and we use this technique all the time of heal, and this is how important. I mean, we're teaching our young dogs how to heal, because I've seen it way too many times where we get done hunting a cattail slough and we're walking across a field and going to the next cattail slough, and those dogs are running ahead and just busting out all the birds. And it's the same, you know, with duck hunting or upland hunting. And that's why healing is so important. So when you come to the line there, we're going to say healing begins when you give your first command. So it doesn't matter where you're standing. You could be standing 5 yards from the first healing stake, or you could be standing right next to the healing stake. As soon as you tell your dog to heal, that's when we start judging. So I generally like to tell handlers to start as close as they feel comfortable to the healing stakes, because once they say heal, and what is a command? You can say it or you could show it. So non-verbally. So let's say you take that leash and you pull it really tight and you like cinch it up. And that's a command. So as soon as you're snapping that leash for healing, that's a command. Or you say heal. And there's 10 stakes, 10 gates out there. So there's 20 stakes total, but there's 10 gates. And there's going to be a slight bend. There might be two bends. And that's, again, simulating going between pond to pond, like Dan was saying, or cattail slough to cattail slough, or field to field. Healing generally will carry over through a lot of hunting situations. And that's why we test for it. And that's why we encourage people to train for it, because you do use it in real life situations. And if you ever do get to the invitational, healing is a big part of that test as well. Another thing about healing is for utility, you do have the option to not use a leash. I've seen it done. I've seen it go okay. And I've seen it go really bad. So you as the handler know that dog, but you do have that option to not use a leash. And like Dan said, you want it to be loose. You don't want it to be tight or taut. I have a tendency when I start healing that my leash is tight, and that doesn't give me any room for my dog to waver a little bit. Because right away, then if the dog decides it's going to go outside the gate or it's going to do something, I'm giving an extra command in there. So you want to make sure you have that loose lead and practice healing all the time. Healing something, if you live in the city, you can practice. You can practice, you know, there's days when it is so cold out in Wisconsin here, we practice healing right inside our garage. We heal within our house, going through obstacles, because when you transition that to the test, it's going to be that much easier to train for. So just be a few things to be prepared for when you're getting ready to heal for utility.
And when you've had an awesome day and the only thing that you fail on is the heel, it's a really bad day.
Well, and that goes back to what I was mentioning earlier about knowing the scorecard. Because you can get a 3 in healing and still get a prize 1 utility score. Mm-hmm. So if you do see the dog starting to get, you know, go out in front of you and the leash gets taut, you know, you need to know that you can give that command to hopefully correct it. So then the rest of it goes smooth and, it, you know, accept getting a 3, but still being able to get a prize 1. So,
right. And so typically, when I'm telling my dog heel, it's a snap of the leash at the same time. Is that going to count as 2 commands if I do them in unison?
No. Nope. You can do it together. That's okay. Generally how I do it as well. But if you don't say anything or you just start walking, that's when we start judging. That's our indication to start judging your healing. So okay. That's why I like to encourage handlers to be close to those healing stakes. We've seen too many people be, you know, 5-10 yards back from the healing stake. We're giving you your instructions, you know, and they're saying heal and they're snapping that lead about 6 times before they even start the healing course. So that's why we have it now that as soon as you give that first command is when we start judging. So if you snap it and say heal at the same time, that's, to me, that's 1 command. That's what I do personally with my own dogs. Okay. I say heel, snap that leash, but I'm right up at that first gate. So there's 10 gates. I'm right at that first gate and I use a nice stern command. I'm heel, you know, and some people don't need to do that. Some people just can say heel and start walking. I like to get in their head right away.
Okay. So if I say heel to beginning and then give a snap of the leash halfway through, that's going to be considered 2 though, right?
Yes. Yeah. You'll probably get some kind of deduction.
Okay.
The other thing to mention too is the kind of leash. You can't have like a slip leash, you know, that simulates more of a, like a choke chain. Mm-hmm. You have to have just a regular flat collar with the leash.
And like Dan said, if you need to make a correction, make it. If your dog's going to go outside the gate, you need to make that correction and you need to pull them in and say heel. You know, that is you know, that's going to be noted, but instead of them missing the gate entirely, you just walk to your blind. That's not a good thing. You want to get back on course and keep the dog right next to you.
So when we're stopping then for the study by blind sequence, we're healing through. And then the healing portion of judging is done when you cross that last gate, or is it when you tell your dog to sit for the blind?
As soon as you get to the blind. So there's going to be a blind set up. So as healing ends, It doesn't end when you go through that last gate. It ends when you get your dog to the blind. So once you get to the blind and you stop, healing stops as well. Judging of healing stops.
Okay. So the dog needs to stop in the healing position without you saying whoa or sit, right? When you stop, it stops. And then that's the healing right there.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah. Okay. That portion's over.
Okay. All right. Now, what does the next one look like?
So your next part is going to be the remain at blind. So what you're going to have to do is, once you get done with healing, you'll be at the blind. You're going to have the option, and the judge is going to tell you, you can either set your dog inside or outside the blind. So it's going to be a blind that's going to be shaped kind of like a C, or sometimes I've seen blinds just be horizontal or perpendicular. It just depends how that judging team has set up the blind. But you're going to want to set your dog up either inside the blind or outside the blind. You want to give them a command. I've seen some handlers have them lay down, teach the down command. I personally say whoa, but do what works for you or what you've trained with. You take the leash off your dog. You can leave the leash. You can leave a hat if you would like. It's done sometimes, not all the time, but you can leave a leash and a hat next to the dog. And then you're going to walk out of sight from the dog. And that dog has to stay in the position that you put them, either inside or outside the blind. So what you're going to do is, again, set them up. And this is how I do it. I say, whoa, I take my leash off, put it next to them. I look at them very sternly. And then I walk where the judge tells me to go, where I'm going to be out of sight. And when I'm out of sight, I'm going to be shooting two blank shots. So I'll be using a gun that will have two blank shots that I'm given to from the judging team. I'm going to shoot one time. I'm going to pause for at least, I try to count to 10, and I'm going to shoot the second time. That entire time, your dog has to stay where they're at. This is the remain at the blind. You're going to come after your second shot all the way back to your dog, and that portion of the test stops. So that's the remain by blind portion. Again, you're out of sight from your dog, and you're simulating like somebody else shooting. So let's say you're in a hunting situation and you're at a pond and somebody next to you is shooting a gun, a different hunting party, or maybe from the same hunting party. You're simulating that your dog is staying in the position where you told them to stay.
In these scenarios, so both the steady at the blind and healing through the stakes, what's going on? What happens if my dog is whining through either of those?
Oh, very good question. Excessive whining will be penalized because you're going to be flaring ducks if it was a real hunting situation. A little bit of whimper is okay, but there is a fine line there, and it's going to be up to the judging team to determine when it's going to affect the score. But if you set your dog up and it's barking, I've seen some dogs all out howl and bark. That will severely affect your remain by the blind score.
Okay. And what about in the retrieve for this part? Because there's some decoys out there. And I know we've had a dog get caught up in the decoys on the retrieve back. And I mean, how is that kind of judged if they get caught up a little bit?
Yeah, that's a whole different kind of sequence. So that's the next step, is that retrieve of duck. Mm-hmm. You know, so generally you're going to have, you know, there's going to be a duck about 50 yards that's going to be launched out of a winger. But what you're going to have the opportunity to do is you're going to then, after the remain, you go back to your dog, and then you're going to set them up on either side of the blind for that mark to retrieve. And this is a setup testing situation, so we will adjust. Maybe we have to redo a little portion of that if something happens, but we will play it out. So if your dog it comes time for your dog to make the retrieve and they get caught up in the decoys, we're going to just see how the dog reacts. And if it hurt the dog or if something happened there, because sometimes those decoys will get in the line of the way the dog is swimming. The judging team will adjust accordingly. But that whole scenario is basically set up. So again, after you get done with the remain, you come back to your dog. After you've done your two shots, that portion of the test is done. Then you set your dog up on either side of the blind. The judging team or your handling judge will give you 4 blank shells. And you have to personally go inside the blind or on the other side of the blind of where your dog is at. And there's going to be a distraction gunner as well. So you're simulating a lot of shooting in a pond. So basically then what happens is you set your dog up. I say, whoa, either on the left or right-hand side of the blind, you'll see the decoys in the water. And what will happen then is a distraction gunner who is going to be far away from you will be signaled to shoot their gun first. Then you are going to shoot your gun over the water. So you're simulating shooting a duck yourself. So it's a distraction gun shot. You shoot. The distraction gunner will shoot again. And then the duck is launched and you'll be instructed to aim at that duck that's launched from the winger and shoot. The whole time your dog has to stay the entire time at a whoa or a stay or whatever command you give that dog. The dog then is released once you say fetch. So we've seen dogs leave early before. That will be penalized. You want to train your dog to stay all the way through the fall. And then you go ahead and release your dog. And then you'll come out behind the blind. Generally, the judge might take your gun from you so that you come out behind the blind and your dog can see you when they're on their way back with the duck to present it to you for the retrieve.
Now, the only difference is there are no decoys for the UPT for that sequence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and UPT, there is no distraction. And
there's no distraction gunning at all?
Nope. For UPT, nope. The duck is launched and you're going to aim at the duck and you are going to pretend to shoot it with your blank gun and your dog has to stay there until you release them.
It's just the one shot that the handler shoots when the duck is thrown and that's it.
Okay.
Yeah. So for UPT, you think about it, you get done with healing. You're going to go up to the blind. You're going to set your dog up on either side of the blind. You're going to get in the blind and right away your duck is going to be launched. You're going to aim at the duck and you're going to shoot and hopefully your dog is still there that you have the time then to give them that retrieve command. So there's not the volley of shots like, and there's not the remain like there is for utility.
Okay. When they get out of the water, we're going right into the physical attributes, just like they did as a natural ability dog. Are you guys looking at anything different or more specific in the utility exam than you did in the natural ability?
It is the same type of evaluation, but a lot of times, these are older dogs now. So with natural ability, there could be a situation where maybe the teeth just haven't come in yet. So they might be marked as missing, a certain tooth. And so the evaluation that's done at the UPT and the utility test for, the attributes, they're adult dogs for the most part. So there could be a difference in what the dog was, what the evaluation was at natural ability compared to now that they're an adult. But we look at all the same things. We look at the teeth, we look at the coat, we check the bite, that kind of stuff.
And a little bit of temperament evaluation, do you guys do that throughout the day? Because I know sometimes I've seen that noted temperament as well in the notes. Or when is temperament, I guess, evaluated?
We look at it specifically after they come out of the water for the retrieve of the thrown duck. But we do note if there's, if usually there is a judge assigned to the handler to walk with them throughout the field portion. and the rest of the day. So each event, it's going to be the same judge that's going to have that handler at, you know, and help them throughout the day. And if they're noticing that, you know, if the dog is acting a little suspicious when the judge is getting close or in different situations, we'll certainly, you know, keep an eye on that to see if it materializes, you know, during the course of the day to anything. But I usually when you're checking the teeth and that kind of thing, that's when if the dog does have some kind of issue, that's really when it shows the most.
Okay. Is this something that's going to be under judgment all day, like even if the dog's being walked back to the vehicle when it comes out of the field? You know, if I don't know, if there turns to be a dog fight or something, is that something that's still under judgment?
We had an unfortunate situation last year where a judge was bit. So I'm part of the judging and testing committee, and we did put through a motion that was accepted by the executive council. So there is a little bit of a change now moving forward. You know, if a dog during the course of a testing day shows aggression towards another dog or towards another, you know, towards a person, then the judges will submit what they witnessed. And then the judging and testing community would evaluate the situation at that time. And it could be a situation where the dog is no longer allowed to test in NAVDA. So it's not just if it's human aggression, if it's also, you know, dog aggression.
Okay.
Yeah. I just want to add to make sure, and I said this in Natural Ability as well, just make sure that you guys practice putting your hands on your dogs, you know, have different people put their hands on the dogs. So they're used to other people putting fingers in their mouths or petting them. It's really an easy thing that you can, you know, work with your dog on just at home while you're watching TV. So even after Natural Ability, if you're getting ready for utility, I do it all the time. I'm all the time, just all of a sudden I'll pull up the gums. I'm watching TV and I pull up the gums on my dog's mouth and look at their teeth and I touch their teeth because I want them used to strangers doing it. And then when I have strangers come over to my house, especially if they're familiar with my dogs, I'll say, hey, could you just do me a favor and look at my dog's teeth so we can just practice it? Because when you do get to that situation at a test, you want to make sure your dog is calm enough to be able to handle that. And dogs that are not exposed to it, and unfortunately, you know, situations happen. If they're not exposed to it, and if you don't prepare for it, that's when things can go wrong. So just kind of keep that in the back of your mind if you're getting ready to run UPT or utility.
Okay. And Dan had mentioned earlier about the importance of knowing the scorecard and understanding it. And so for a lot of us testing, you know, we all kind of strive for that coveted prize one. Can you guys touch on which areas we need to earn fours in throughout the test in order to earn that prize one?
These are the areas that you need a four. You need a four in the search for the duck. You need a four in pointing. You need a four in your nose work, which is judged throughout the day. You need a four in your desire work, which is judged throughout the day. So it's four different areas. So duck search, pointing, nose, and desire. The rest of the areas, you can get a three in. And again, this is all laid out pretty well in the aims and test rules booklet that you can get that prize one. And, you know, we're kind of touching on people always want to work for that prize one. Everybody, when you're training, you work for the prize one. But please don't be disappointed if you get a prize three or a prize two, because you still have an exceptional hunting dog. And my first dog that I ever ran a utility test in, when I got a prize three, you would have thought I won the lottery. So really, really be proud of yourself if you accomplish, especially as a first-time handler, that you pass a NAVDA UPT or utility test, because it takes a lot of training. It takes a lot of time. It takes a lot of travel. It really takes a lot of work. So be proud that you do. And yes, everybody, the more we go on, everybody's striving for that prize one. And when I start training my dogs, I train for the prize one. But if it doesn't happen, you still have an exceptional dog. And as me, as a breeder, if I have puppy buyers that are utility testing dogs from my bloodline and they utility NABDA test and prize their dog, I'm just as ecstatic. And to me, that is a well-rounded dog, and it's going to be a great hunting dog as well. And I'm going to continue with my breeding program, especially if I've got people utility testing puppies from me. So absolutely, please keep that in mind. We keep saying that prize one. And yes, you need a prize one in order to be asked to go to the NABDA Invitational. But for first-time handlers, passing a utility test is a pretty darn good accomplishment.
Something else that I wanted to add also is because of COVID, it kind of set us back a little bit, but we're working on putting together a NABDA utility video similar to the one that we did for Natural Ability. We got really good response from people. It really went through what is expected during the course of the day and explained a lot of the events, and we're going to try to do the same thing for the utility test. Obviously, it's more entailed because of the nature of the utility test has a lot more going on than a natural ability test, but that's coming. So we're going to try to be able to get back and do that. We're working with a vendor now that is hopefully going to be able to start working on filming it and put it into production. So that'll be out there for people to view and understand if they can't get to one of the NABDA events.
Awesome. A similar question I had in the natural ability test, as far as like when should you consider retesting in utility? Dan, you had mentioned earlier with how difficult it is in that duck search portion that you keep trying to move above from that three to that four. How many times or what kind of dog do you have that you know that it would be worth retesting it to try to get that prize one?
I don't know. That's really a personal kind of evaluation the individual has to do. So if something goofy happens during the course of the test and you think that, the reason why maybe I didn't get a prize one is because I got a two in healing, might be different than somebody that thinks that the steadiness portion of the test, like I mentioned earlier, some people allow their dogs during the hunting season to break on the shot and they just maybe have trouble with that and they get something other than a prize one, let's say, and they're happy with it because they know that they hunt that way and they know their dog's going to break on the shot and that's okay for them. So I don't know that you can really answer that. It really, if you think the dog has reached its full potential and you're happy with the score, I don't know if retesting is something that you want to do or not. Maybe it is, but it's really on the individual and the individual dog and what their goals are when they, when they kind of started down the NABDA road.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I generally, the only time personally when I retest my dog is if it is a dog that I know has the capability of going to the Invitational, because that's personally what I train for and thrive for. But if I'm just looking for, when I first started out and when I ran my first NABDA utility test in 2009 and I got that prize three, I was happy. I tested one more time after that, but the Invitational at that point in my NABDA training and knowledge and career, I wasn't really to that point of trying to advance to the Invitational. So I was happy with my prize three dog and I just kept hunting. Mm-hmm. So again, it really is a personal decision. And what your ultimate overall goal is. And maybe some people have breeders that have goals. There's some breeding programs that, and different breed groups that have goals that you need to reach a certain prize level in NABDA. And that's, if you don't get that, then go ahead and retest. But again, it really is a personal decision.
Mm-hmm. And what about things that handlers should bring to the test? So besides the proper leash and collar, like Dan mentioned earlier, what else should we be prepared to have with us?
Well, you're going to be in the field with live ammo. So because we have two gunners, we require everybody to wear orange. We prefer everybody has an orange hat on, but at least one article of clothing has to be orange. Water is extremely important. We've talked about that throughout the day. Make sure you have water with you, especially for the field part of the test and the retrieve of the drag. And if it's hot, you know, water for yourself, stuff that you need for yourself. A chair is always good. Rain gear, you never know. Sunscreen, especially that day of a test. And then the summertime, you want to be prepared for any and all types of weather. And I can tell you the one thing, again, you cannot have a shock collar with you. Your dogs can only have one collar on. A Seresto collar is fine. No training aids, no slip leads. You cannot do a suitcase lead type thing for a utility test or a UPT test. We're a little bit more advanced and we're beyond that puppy stage that we should be able to at least perform on a regular flat buckled collar and leash.
The one thing that I do notice, especially with people that are maybe new to NAVDA, is, you know, they come to a test and they have no way to restrain their dog when the dog is not running. So I would, you know, kind of think about my personal preference is a crate, you know, bring a crate with you. But at the very least, like a stakeout, you know, I do see some people just leave the dog loose in the vehicle. And, you know, if the dog is watching what's going on with all these other dogs that are running in the field or at the water all day long, it gets them worked up unnecessarily. And that could lead to problems when you do release your dog when it's your turn. So I prefer a crate and I make sure that my dogs can't see what's going on during the you know, the course of the day with, you know, with the rest of the dogs that are maybe doing the event while I'm waiting. But I think that's something that a lot of people overlook that maybe aren't used to, you know, traveling with a dog and going to these kinds of events.
Good point. On the topic of the shotguns, in AKC hunt tests, you can use a fake type of gun. So, I mean, I know several people have like a broom handle that they've put a broken old stock on, and that's sufficient to be able to go through the motions. In the utility test, what kind of shotgun can they have?
So
or is required, I should say, sorry.
Yeah, so the field portion of the test, I have seen, you know, a fake gun used by the chapter where they'll take maybe an old single shotgun that doesn't fire or anything, you know. And but obviously for the portion of the remain by blind, you need a working shotgun. Most chapters have a shotgun that the handler can use if they don't have their own. But I know that I see a lot of the handlers want to use a gun for that portion of the test that they're familiar with so they can make, you know, they can fire the shots and not have to worry about how the gun actually works. But I have seen fake guns that look like a gun used in the field portion, because all you need to do is swing on the bird. You have gunners out out there that are going to actually kill the bird.
Okay. Are we as handlers able to choose our own gunners or even bring two friends that we know are sure shots as our gunners for our portion of the test?
No,
you are not. No, but if you do have someone that you think highly of, my suggestion would be to see if maybe they could gun for everybody that day. Because that's it's a very difficult, it's such a crucial part of the test, and it's very difficult to find good gunners that are consistent. So in that scenario you just mentioned, I would say that maybe you see if the individuals that that you're talking about would gun for the whole day and gun for everybody.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Do they need to go through any kind of approval or process to do that?
There's kind of a safety outline that the senior judge will go over with the gunners in the morning of each test. That's for, you know, for the utility test. There's different parameters for the invitational. You have to be recommended. But utility is really, you want the chapter to select proven gunners, and then the senior judge will review the safety requirements. The scenario you just mentioned, calling safety. Sometimes there'll be a situation where the senior judge will want a shot fired in the air, just so we can judge the dog on steady to shot. If it's not, if the bird maybe is flying to the gallery, we'll just fire a shot and have the gunners fire a shot in the air, so we can still evaluate that. Obviously, we can't evaluate the fall or the retrieve, and that's all covered with the gunners in the morning.
Okay. Excellent. Well, we covered a lot today, you guys, yeah. And I appreciate it. I think, as we mentioned before, the best way to learn is to help at your chapter's training and testing days, instead of just showing up on the day of the test and hoping you have it, all well-versed on it. And you can listen to this, but there's nothing like being there in action, helping out and taking your dog through the different training opportunities.
And, like I mentioned before, asking the handler if you can walk in the field.
Yeah.
And then the other thing that helped me tremendously, and I'm sure, Angie has the same kind of feeling, is I wanted to be a better handler. So I got into the NAVDA apprentice program, and I learned so much in that NAVDA apprentice program that helped me as a handler, stuff that I wouldn't have learned any other way. You see so many different breeds of dogs and see so many different things that happen out there. And then you can, kind of gauge, how to train for stuff like that. It's just invaluable, I think, as a handler. So it's something else to think about.
Mm-hmm. Dan, can you go through that apprentice program without ever having intentions of wanting to actually become a judge?
Some people, for whatever reason, don't finish the program. You have to run a dog in utility to start out with. And then you have to attend, one of the, Ames clinics. And that's what Angie was referring to, earlier, and that helps because you understand all the rules and what goes into the different tests. There's a lot of people that go through it, and for whatever reason, they don't become a judge. But I just think, regardless, you're just a better handler for going through the program.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I'd like to add to, utility or UPT, especially for first-time handlers, people get really nervous, and we understand that. We're there to help you through that test, and we want to make sure that you're as successful as we possibly can. We're all judged based on a standard. It's not first place, second place, or third place. It's based on the standard. And we want people to, enjoy their time there as well. So as judges, we're going to be there to help you. And, we have a lot of experience with it. And as judges, we're required to run utility dogs, UPT or higher, every 4 years. And, we have to prize our dogs because we have to be in that situation as well to see what it's like to be a handler. And I can tell you, I get just as nervous like it's my first day, because I know how much, you put into it, how much your dog can do it, but it's one day, it's a snapshot of the day, and we have such a short amount of time to evaluate your dogs. So just the fact that you've worked up to this point to get them ready for utility or UPT, and that you're doing it, I think you're already ahead of the game, and you've got a great hunting dog. So we understand nerves play into a factor here, but please understand that we've all been there, and we're going to just try to help you through the test the best we can. And in the end, you're still going to take your dog home, and you're going to hunt with them and love them up.
Awesome. Well, thank you, guys. And like Dan mentioned, the utility video is hopefully on the way. It's in the works, so that'll be exciting to come out to give us a visual of what you guys went through on this podcast today. And one more shout out to where people can find more information.
Yep, NABDA.org. We do have a presence also on Facebook and Instagram, but basically everything that we've talked about today in the AIMS and test rules booklet can be found on NABDA.org. You can find tests on NABDA.org, local chapters that are holding tests and training days. So basically the NABDA.org will lead you to a chapter, and then you need to contact those chapters that are within your region. You know, there's 85 plus chapters across the country. Find one that's closest to you, contact them, find out when they're having a training day, find out when they're having a testing day, and get involved. Volunteer. Again, NABDA is based on our volunteers. We're a volunteer organization. We don't exist without volunteers. The judges are all volunteers. Everybody from planning your bird to all the chapter members or cooking a lunch are all volunteers. So if you're running a test, pay it forward, volunteer, so we can keep going on and people can keep training and testing their dogs.
Thank you both very much. I appreciate it.
Yeah.
Thank you. I appreciate you asking me to be on. It was a lot of fun.
Thanks for listening to another episode of the Bird Dog Babe podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, share it and tag me and someone that would benefit from listening. Please help me out by giving the podcast a rating and review on whichever platform you're listening from, and hit subscribe so you don't miss an episode. Be sure to join me on Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. And if you're interested in some Bird Dog Babe swag or gear that I rely on, be sure to check out the store on thebirddogbabe.com. And most importantly, don't forget to support the organizations that are working hard to conserve the birds you're chasing after and the public lands in which you hunt.